Hi, everybody. Welcome to this session. It's my absolute pleasure to introduce Dr. Ryan Ritterson for his session, Pandemic-Proof PPE and AI Safety, Using Evidence and Analysis to Effectively Inform Public Policy. Ryan Ritterson serves as Executive Vice President for Research at Griffin Scientific, a US-based consulting firm. At Griffin, Dr. Ritterson has led research and analyses that have provided landmark contributions to biosafety, biosecurity, and the reduction of global catastrophic risks. As a reminder, if you have questions, please pop them in the Swapcard app. And at the end of the presentation, I'll take a mix of pre-prepared questions and audience questions. And then after this session, there'll be office hours with Ryan in room 208 directly afterwards. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Ryan Ritterson.
Good morning, everybody. I'm really happy to be here to talk to you about Griffin Scientific's approach to impact and the way that we go about influencing public policy. I want this to be mostly informal. My session today is going to talk to you broadly about our approach to impact, and with that, shade it with some stories of the work that we've done over the last 15 years. So that's why I'm here. I'm here to talk to you about Griffin's approach to impact. One thing that I want to emphasize is, by design, I don't think I'm going to tell you anything earth-shattering. And that's actually a good thing. What I want you to know is that the approaches that we take to influencing public policy are things that anybody could do. There's not a deep secret, right? There's not some secret code that has to be unlocked. But before I get into how Griffin works, just a little bit about myself and how I got to where I am. At the age of 18, I set out to college believing that I was going to be a hardware engineer. My dream was to work on embedded systems in the automotive industry. And that was by intent, which is why I've given that a solid line. But what happened almost immediately is I ended up in a completely different area of computational biology, mostly by accident, which is why I have that as a dotted line. In fact, the primary accident that occurred was I checked the wrong box on my college application, didn't understand that I had done that until I had already agreed to show up, and they told me that I couldn't fix that error until I was there for at least a year. And in that first year, doing what I had checked and said I was going to want to do was actually more interesting to me than what I had originally intended. As I completed college, I really got interested in making contributions to basic research. So I went off to grad school and believing I was going to be a computational biologist. Through another happy accident, based on an idea that I developed with some colleagues, I switched completely from working in the computational space to working at the wet lab as an experimental biologist. Near the end of my time in grad school, I realized that, in fact, being at the research bench was probably not for me. The kind of contributions that I could make to the world working on at the research bench were good contributions, but I wanted to make contributions of a different type and really wanted to influence policy. Given my background in the life sciences, I focused on science policy. So science policy is things like how much research funding should we give researchers, what should the oversight mechanisms over research be, etc. In thinking about working in science policy as I finished my PhD around the age of 30, I thought Congress was really where I wanted to go. Congress seemed like the hot area, could really make a big difference by influencing legislation. But it turned out, based on my interests, Congress is actually not the right place for me. And although I had a design in going into Congress, quickly after talking to folks who did and had worked in Congress, that it wasn't going to be a good fit for me. But then accidentally, I got connected to Griffin Scientific through a friend of a friend. Our executive chair, Rocco Casagrande, actually blind messaged me on LinkedIn, talking to me about an opportunity, had a conversation with him. And I like to tell the story. After talking to him, I really was interested in the work, but he told me that I needed to move across country from the Bay Area to DC, and I would have had to leave my wife behind in order to do that. And was a little bit scared and told my wife, you know, I just had a really great conversation about some work that's super interesting, but I'm not sure I want to go long distance. So I said no. And she quickly said, you know, this sounds like the perfect job for you. I think you're getting in your own way and you should go do it. And so the rest is history. I've been at Griffin for about 10 years. A little bit about Griffin. We like to define ourselves as a mission-oriented or impact-first consulting company. And we are a for-profit business, but we're not in the business to make money. We're in the business to have an impact. We're life science-focused. Most of us at Griffin have a technical background in the life sciences. A lot of us have PhDs. And we bring a data-driven and analytical approach to society's greatest and most difficult challenges. That's a bit of a grandiose statement. It really should say on my slide, we bring a data-driven and analytical approach to some of society's most difficult challenges, because we're approaching it from the life science angle, and there's, of course, a lot of great challenges that are not life science related. And in our approach to impact, we've been fortunate enough to be funded by several members of the EA community. And I will say most of the work that Griffin does is focused on having an impact on federal policymaking. Historically, most of our clients have been the federal government. Most of the consumers of our outputs are the federal government, although, as it says on the slide, we've been funded by the EA community. We've done work for national governments elsewhere. We've also done work for intergovernmental organizations like the WHO. So this slide shows you a little bit about how the policymaking process works. Now, if you were in government, you'd probably take issue with some of the things I said on this slide. It's not designed to be a perfect description. It's designed to be illustrative. On the left side, I'm showing you sort of a notional way of how policymaking occurs in the legislative branch. It starts at the top with political priorities, where Congress decides what issues it's going to care about in the current session. From there, the broad outlines of legislation are developed, what missions and what areas are going to be affected by this legislation. From there, it goes into the details of the legislation, what specific actions are going to be prescribed. And then finally, as the bill reaches completion before it's voted on, the specifics get in there. Exactly how are those actions going to be implemented and what are the requirements going to be? On the other side, I'm showing you the executive branch, where you have overall government policy set at high-level organizations like OSTP, which is the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House, NSC, which is the National Security Council, and other high-level organizations like that. When overall government policy is set, those get pushed down to the agencies and departments within the executive branch, who are tasked with implementing that policy in accordance with what the White House has told them to do. From there, the agencies begin to think about how they're going to implement their priorities and need to make decisions about how that's going to happen. And then once they've made those decisions, there's the business of actually operating government. So Griffin focuses on these bottom two on the left and the top three on the right. So we don't actually work in policymaking across all areas. The reason we focus on these areas is this is where we think our data-driven analysis can actually have the biggest impact. I will say Griffin does do some work in operational support in that bottom right there. I'm not talking about that today because that doesn't influence policymaking, which is the focus of my talk. But it is important work, and there are opportunities for folks with a technical background to get involved there. So two things I want to emphasize. First, we are not the only model to do this. There's a lot of other ways to influence policymaking. So just want to say we are one model. We are not the only model. And I will also say our view is outside in. So if you want to work for government and work inside government to influence policymaking, there's a lot of mechanisms to do that. I'm not going to talk about how that's done. We influence government from the outside in. So the four keys that we believe are key to our ability to make an impact. The first is come with receipts. Second, trust is paramount. Third, strike while the iron is hot. And lastly, pick your passions. So what I want to do is walk you through a little bit more detail about what does it mean when I say come with receipts? What does it mean when I say trust is paramount? And what are some examples of how we've lived those keys? So first, when I talk about come with receipts, what I mean is when you're talking to policymakers, come armed with evidence, reasons, and data to support your position. And be ready to say, I don't know. And I want to emphasize the ability to say, I don't know, is incredibly powerful in policymaking. It really helps policymakers understand whether they can trust what you're saying. If you're willing to say, I don't know, when you don't know an answer, they're much more likely to believe what you're saying when you do say you have an answer. What you shouldn't do is speculate, conjecture, or guess, even if asked. That's the opposite of saying, I don't know. And we think, at Griffin, we think that undermines our ability to influence policymaking in the way that we would like to. So for example, on that right side, and as I'll talk about a little bit later in my talk, over the last year, Griffin has been fortunate enough to participate in a lot of evals and red teaming work related to AI and bio. And as part of that, we're often asked questions that are of interest to policymakers that are related to that work. One question I've been asked a lot is, what do you think about open source models? Are they going to be a problem with risk? And I say, I have a personal opinion on that problem, but I am not a tech person. I am not a software engineer. I am not an AI model developer. I am a biologist by training. You need to go find someone that understands the implications of open source better than I do in order to get an informed position on that issue. Why does this matter? So first, consensus building is much easier if you have data and evidence to support arguments. In the absence of data and evidence, every position is somewhat equally supportable, and you cannot reach consensus and cannot begin to build toward a solution. Second, when interacting with policymakers, you often only get to interact with the first step in a long chain. You may get to meet and talk to one person in an office who listens to you, who then turns around and goes and talks to someone else in that office, who goes and talks to someone else in that office, et cetera. By bringing evidence to the table to support the position you're making, those folks, if they like what you have to say, can take that evidence forward to the additional people that they want to talk to, and that improves your ability to influence government. Similar to that, and somewhat opposite, if the evidence and analysis you're bringing to support policymaking does travel, sometimes those individuals will reach out to you and want to know more. And so over time, you can use the data-driven analysis you've developed to increase your influence. And lastly, Griffin fundamentally believes that evidence leads to better outcomes than conjecture. So looking at some projects where we brought data to the table, first I'm going to talk to you about a project that we undertook in 2010, which was developing guidance that HHS released on DNA synthesis screening. So this is companies that produce DNA on demand and to spec by those that order it. And the idea was that someone that wants to seek harm could order DNA from a pathogen or some other sequence that could cause harm, and we wanted to be able to spot those orders and prevent those orders from being filled. And I will say, this was the first guidance that was released. As you can see, it's about 15 years old. This project has now been overcome by many newer and updated efforts that take into account the growth of this industry and the growth of technology since this guidance was published. What we did in this case is we did dozens of interviews with industry, did analysis to the specific pathways that we thought could lead to the realization of the threat of a malicious actor misusing these services, and did analysis of the impact of the options available to us to mitigate those risks. And armed with that evidence and data that we brought to HHS, they essentially took our recommendations and turned our recommendations into this guidance that was released, and you can see the cover there on the right side. And just to give you one example of why we think evidence and data is important, we recommended in our analysis to HHS that oligonucleotides, which are short pieces of DNA that are then assembled together to make larger pieces of DNA, not be specifically covered. That we should cover only the larger segments of DNA. And the reason that we recommended that was because in talking to industry, the oligonucleotide providers told us, well, if you're going to release guidance that we're not obligated to follow, implementing the guidance that we need to screen every order is going to ruin our profitability model, and so we're going to simply ignore the guidance. And so we told HHS, you know, in order to foster the greatest improvements in security, you want your guidance to be widely adopted. So don't push out guidance that industry is likely to ignore, because if they ignore one piece of it, they're likely to ignore it wholesale. Next study that I want to talk to you about, some of you may remember headlines in the middle of the last decade that said things like, scientists are creating new incurable diseases in labs, is that okay? Or mutant bird flu study fuels fears of airborne H5N1, virus experiments risk unleashing a global pandemic. What happened was some papers were published where two research groups, one in the US and one in the Netherlands, modified influenza, a bird influenza, to be transmissible between ferrets as a proxy for understanding if that virus could become transmissible between people. They demonstrated it was possible, and then the question was, should we be creating these viruses? Could someone misuse them to cause a pandemic, or could they get out of a lab accidentally and cause a pandemic? As you can see on the bottom left, what the US government decided to do was halt funding nationally for controversial research, which they defined as research on coronaviruses and influenza. So it's interesting to think about responsible scaling policies in AI and conversations around implementing an AI pause should a technological capability be developed that we don't know how to appropriately mitigate. This is a precedent for that kind of pause, where the US government believed that we had gained a scientific life science capability that may be too dangerous for us to control and wanted to deliberately pause work and evaluate how we could move forward. Griffin was contracted by HHS to analyze the risks and benefits of gain-of-function research, and this was a relatively monumental undertaking. Some of you may have seen this report. I wanted to bring a copy as a prop. It's about 1,000 pages long, and it literally would not fit in my carry-on suitcase. And undertaking this work, we did about 100 conversations with stakeholders. We produced about 1,000 pages of content, which took us about 10,000 man-hours of work. Now, is this much work required for every policy issue? No. But we really think that the level of analysis and data we were able to contribute to this conversation, this national level and international level conversation, was critical to getting the multi-stakeholder groups that were really at each other's throats about how to proceed at the same table and discussing how to move forward. More recent work that I'll mention briefly is our work funded by Effective Giving, Blueprint Bio, and Open Philanthropy on pandemic-proof PPE. There's a lot of words on these slides, but the takeaway is coming out of the coronavirus pandemic, it was pretty clear that there's vulnerabilities and gaps in PPE's use to mitigating the influence of a pandemic. But those gaps are of many types. Some are logistical, some are biomedical, some are societal, and some are engineering. And it's not obvious, or it wasn't obvious before we began this work, which of those gaps, if surmounted, would best improve the ability for PPE to be resilient and useful in a future pandemic. The other thing is the coronavirus pandemic was only one of many possible pandemics humankind could experience. And so we didn't want to overfit our analysis of gaps to COVID specifically. We wanted to make sure that any interventions that we implemented could be meaningful for any potential future pandemic. The way that we went about this is characterized PPE gaps that hampered response to previous pandemics, and then did some modeling to analyze PPE performance and figure out what kind of PPE would be necessary to protect individuals based on the specifics of that pandemic. We combined that data to define requirements and the gaps that should be surmounted to improve PPE. And then in the latest stages of this project, as we wrap it up, we're identifying opportunities for funding to put into place those interventions. I don't have time, unfortunately, today to talk to you about all the results of this project. We'd be here all day. But just to talk to you about some of the things that we discovered, some of the things that we considered in our analysis, I'll give you a few examples here. The first is that today, PPE standards are defined in the United States only for, quote unquote, workers. There's no standards for the public, including for children. I have a 4.5-year-old son at home. If you do the math, he was quite young when the pandemic started. And through most of the pandemic, he was required to wear a mask when we were in public or he was in school. It's interesting to think that the PPE that he wore that entire time, there were no standards. No one was evaluating how effective it could be. Second, PPE is not really designed for body diversity. Most PPE today has been designed based on the bodies of European and American cisgendered men. If you're not one of those individuals, it's likely that the PPE doesn't fit you well. So for example, men who are non-Western and of different stature may not fit properly into the sizes that have already been defined. In addition, PPE is not well-sized for the female body and the different anthropomorphic ratios that the female body has distinct from the male body. And we find often in practice is that women that wear PPE take on the male sizes but have to wear one size bigger in order to get it to fit, leading to an overall poor fit. Some of the modeling that we did, we modeled three scenarios, the first of two people talking to each other, the second where a second person comes and talks to a person temporarily and leaves, and then third, two people talking outside. And what you can see from this slide is that disposable N95s, that middle column of five, provides at least 4 hours of protection in these scenarios against infection from a measles-like pandemic, which is really interesting for us. And it was a great finding because that means that the level of protection of existing PPE is actually sufficient to provide strong protection if we can surmount the other gaps like fit, availability, comfort, et cetera. And then lastly, we looked at supply chain resilience for PPE. This is meant to be illustrative, it's not to scale. And what you're seeing is, you know, in steady state, non-pandemic, there's a balance between the demand for PPE and the production of PPE. They're relatively equivalent. But when a pandemic starts, the need for PPE rapidly increases well beyond what production demand can or production supply can meet. What we analyzed and recommended here is a multi-tier stockpile method where you have user-managed inventories, which are users of PPE maintaining additional stocks beyond what they would normally need, vendors and distributors doing the same thing, and then supplemented at the top there with government stockpiles to backstop the other two. In doing this, you allow for PPE to be more rapidly distributed when the need increases. You're not relying on the government to distribute it everywhere. And you're also not relying upon the government to maintain the entirety of an enormous stockpile. And under this method, you'd imagine, for example, that the government would subsidize vendors and users to maintain additional PPE beyond what they normally require. Moving on to the second of the four keys, trust is paramount. So what I mean here is when you're working to influence government, be patient with the relationships that you build. That you can't expect to maximize your impact the first time out. It may take a while in order to begin to develop influence. Why does this matter? So first, attention is time limited. Policymakers have to cover a range of issues, and the amount of time they have to spend on the specific issue that you're interested in may be limited. Because of that, they go back to the people that they know that can give them the answers that they need, so they're not wasting their limited time talking to people that are not informative. Second, policymakers are people just like you and me, right? When you have an important question and you're seeking input, there's a trusted network of people that you go to talk about that. And you wouldn't necessarily accept advice from a random individual that you met that you had never interacted with before. Third, your network stays with you. The relationships that you build in the beginning of your career become critical allies and critical movers in different places as your career advances. And then lastly, policymakers do really want the best outcome. In our interactions with government, we have a strong belief that the individuals in government are seeking the overall best outcome. And as a result, they seek out individuals that they know can help them do that. They go to the individuals that they trust. But traction, building that trust, may take years. So Griffin, through our work on biosafety, which is the prevention of harm caused by biological materials resulting from an accident, we realized in this work that the attention posed to the catastrophic risk of a biosafety incident was probably undervalued, and that improvements in biosafety were really needed in order to mitigate that catastrophic risk. We first started thinking about this problem in 2012 when we did our first quantitative biosafety risk assessment. That was expanded in 2015 when we did the gain of function assessment that I talked about a few slides earlier. From there in 2017, my colleague Rocco and I published a paper at M-Sphere making the first public call for improvements to biosafety funding. In 2020, we were fortunate to receive a $2 million grant from OpenPhil to conduct some empirical biosafety research to demonstrate to the globe what data were missing and how improvements and experiments could really improve biosafety. And from there, that's led to us having greater influence and greater impact in biosafety. In 2022, we were asked by the World Health Organization to rewrite the poliovirus biosafety standard known as GAP, for Global Action Plan. And most recently, last year, we started a project funded by the State Department to develop a global biosafety research agenda to help unite the global community behind what work is most urgently needed. So as you can see, 2012 was when we first started realizing this challenge, and it wasn't really until 2020 that it gained traction. And now, you know, 11 years in, we're able to do some work of global international importance. So just a couple of results from some of that work I showed on the previous slide. So here's results from our OpenPhil grant. So for those of you that have not worked in a life science laboratory before, what I'm showing you at the bottom right are four pictures of ways to open what's called a microcentrifuge tube. So these are small little plastic tubes that hold the liquids that you're analyzing within the laboratory. And where life scientists are taught not to flick these open with one hand, which is that leftmost image. You're supposed to open them with two hands to prevent material from splattering out as you open them. And there's multiple ways to do that. I'm showing you three different methods in that the gloved hands to the right of the bare hands. What we wanted to know is, well, how safe is it actually to open these tubes? And we did that by putting a fluorescent tracer dye in the liquid in the tube, had individuals open those tubes, and then we used a UV lamp to check for fluorescence on their hands, on the bench around them, and on their lab coats. You can see the data on the right. No matter how you open these tubes, it's pretty bad. If you look at the glove column, right, no matter how you open these tubes, greater than 70% or more of the time, the gloves are contaminated. That was pretty stunning for us. You know, we assumed that there'd be some contamination, but not to this degree. Material also gets elsewhere, right? You have a not insignificant chance of getting material on the bench and a not insignificant chance of material getting on your lab coat. This and the other research has led us to believe that mishaps that occur in the laboratory may be more common than we think. This research has actually demonstrated biosafety may be in a worse position than we realized before we began these studies. And we're continuing to work with folks around government and the EA community to continue to expand this kind of research. And then just a little bit about the global biosafety research agenda that we're working on. We received a grant from the State Department last year to undertake a 3-year project to gather from experts around the world gaps in evidence that could lead to research opportunities to improve biosafety. We're actually enacting a recommendation that was made by a G7 experts panel and then reinforced by the US National Science and Technology Council. And in the third year of this project, our intention is to go on a roadshow with this research agenda in collaboration with the State Department to gather interested funders and interested performers in the hopes of actually enacting this research agenda. So third key tenet, strike while the iron is hot. What this means is there may be a window of time, a sudden window of time that opens where an issue that you care about is of interest to everybody else. So you need to be ready to switch gears if the moment comes and one of these issues suddenly becomes hot. And you need to keep ideas in your back pocket so that when the moment is right, you can bring them to the forefront and take action on them. On the flip side, don't be afraid to upend your priorities. Don't get stuck focused on one or two things, right? There may come a time where you need to drop what you were doing and focus on something else in order to have that impact that you're looking to make. The greatest example I have of that is the work that Griffin has done over the last year related to AI. Griffin has approached the AI question from our bio side. So we have participated in a number of AI bio assessments and conversations. So I want to emphasize we're not AI experts. We are bio experts, and that is the influence that we've had. We started this work about 9 months ago, and in that time, we've collaborated with Anthropic, OpenAI, and others on evals and red teaming exercises related to AI and bio. We've testified to Congress. We worked with the UK Frontier AI Task Force. We've briefed top government executives on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean and had a strong influence on informing the United States executive order on AI that was released late last year. And this work has moved much faster and much more intensely than we are used to working at the pace of government. But we dropped everything and focused our resources on this issue because we believe it's really important. And the window of opportunity is maybe narrow. So we want to be able to have the impact while we can. One slide on the kind of work that we've done with Anthropic and others. So Griffin developed a 7-step pathway from ideation to effect of a biological weapon, and then evaluated whether and how LLMs could provide useful knowledge for a malicious actor seeking to undertake these 7 steps. And if you're interested in the results of these studies, I would say, broadly speaking, we have some concerns about the information that LLMs may be providing. But for more details, there's public posts by Anthropic as well as the testimony that we've offered that provide more details. So where is Griffin going next with AI? So one thing that we realized is that there's a broad need for bio capabilities in assessing the risks of the intersection of AI and bio, and that Griffin doesn't have the capability to do that to the degree that it's needed. In addition, you know, we're a consulting company, so we sell hours of our people's time, and all things considered, our time is not affordable by many segments of the community that could really use assistance with the AI and bio questions. So our hope is to turn the bespoke analyses that we've been able to do for some of the biggest providers and help develop rigorous approaches and standards that others may be able to enact to ensure that the evals and red teaming exercises that are taken on are sufficient to understand and mitigate the risks. We're also collaborating with NTI, which is the Nuclear Threat Institute, who also has a focus on biosecurity, to set up a global AI ex bio stakeholder forum The aim there being to roll up our sleeves and begin to move and take action on many of the things that are needed in the biosecurity space that we and others across the globe have raised. If you're interested in learning more about the stakeholder forum, we would love your participation. NTI announced it publicly on LinkedIn. They'd love to hear from you. I would also love to hear from you about your interest in participating here and what you think this forum should do. And then my last slide, know your passions. The message that I want to leave you with is what you choose not to spend your time on, I think, is more important than what you choose to spend your time on. There's a lot of things that one could do in order to try to make an impact in this space and others. And if you divide your time too finely across too many interests, I think that there's a high likelihood you'll fail to reach maximum potential. So to really make sure that you have the impact you're looking for, focus on the things that are most important to you. And how you define most important can be a number of ways, right? It could be the things you're most interested in. It could be the things you're most expert in. It could be the things that you think have the greatest leverage toward what our future looks like. But broadly speaking, I would say think carefully about the causes you choose to get involved in to make sure that you can have the impact you're looking for. So once again, Griffin's four keys to impact. So first, come with receipts. Second, trust is paramount. Third, strike while the iron is hot. And lastly, pick your passions. And with that, I want to say thank you, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thanks so much for that overview. I guess to kick us off, you and Griffin obviously have deep expertise here in like the kind of making things happen in the policy space. What do you think the EA community might be missing or underappreciating about work in this field?
That's a great question. So I think working with government is a little bit different than working with other stakeholder groups, right? Governments operate a bit differently. Their priorities are a bit different. Their mechanisms are a bit different. Their timeline is a bit different. And I think understanding how to interact with government effectively is something that I've learned over my 10 years at Griffin. And I think the EA community could put a greater emphasis on interacting with government and beginning to learn how to have greater influence with that stakeholder group.
Mm-hmm. Are there any kind of common mistakes that you see, maybe not just even in the EA community, but in other communities that are early on in their kind of relationship to working in policy and government?
Yeah, I would say the trust is paramount key that I listed, I think, is the one that is most misunderstood. Mm-hmm. That it's not about waiting until government is interested and then jumping in, barnstorming government with your ideas on the topic they're thinking about. It's about consistent engagement with government so that you can begin to understand their priorities, the way that they think about their issues, and be someone that they can call on when they have questions.
Mm. And how do you handle that, I guess, when it feels like it's your priorities aren't on the top of the list? Because I guess it could be a long period. I mean, we've seen biosecurity and AI rise in the agenda pretty prominently in the last few years. But I guess for other issues, you don't know when that iron is going to strike.
That's right. Yeah. So as I said in the beginning of the presentation, you know, we're not the only model. Certainly there are advocacy organizations around government. And their role is to bring attention to the things that they think government is not paying attention to. Mm-hmm. So that's one model. We choose as an organization not to advocate, partially because we think we can be more effective elsewhere, but partially because as a recipient of federal funds, we're not allowed to do anything related to lobbying because of the obvious conflicts of interest that would create. Mm-hmm. But part of it too, I think, is really accepting that government might not care about the same things that you do all the time, and not letting that get you down, not letting that stop the work you're doing, not letting that frustrate you, continuing to engage with government, right? You saw from the biosafety example that government didn't really care when we started first thinking about biosafety. We didn't let that get us down. We continued to move on that issue, and we're eventually able to be persuasive. Mm-hmm.
And then how do you prioritize projects within Griffin, given, I guess, you work with governments and also nonprofit projects?
Yeah. You know, I think It's a combination of the issues that we think are critical to address and the availability of funds to tackle those issues, right? So we go after our highest priority issues that someone is willing to let us tackle.
Great. And is there anything on that list that you wish people were more interested in funding that they aren't? Or do you feel like you are, in fact, working on the things you think are top priority?
By and large, I think we've been fortunate that others have cared about the things that we care about. One of the things that we've been thinking about is the development of AI tools that are trained on biological data. So not trained on language, not trained on images, but trained on DNA and, and other components of biological data, and the influence that those tools are going to have on the ability to cause harm. I think today, that risk isn't really realizable. That field is in its real infancy, but much like LLMs exploded onto the scene and were a suddenly useful tool for a broad swath of society, I think the same is going to be true with these biological design tools. And now is the right time to begin thinking about what those risks are, thinking about how we'll scale those tools so that we can evaluate capabilities long before they become realized.
And I guess also so that you have answers for policymakers when they care about it in some number of months or years.
That's right, yeah.
Great. Have you ever had to defend a regulation or kind of advance an idea that was unpopular, and you had to kind of maybe combat some misunderstanding or misinformation amongst policymakers? And how did you do that?
Yes. So there have been times where the evidence and analysis that Griffin has done has gone against you know, longstanding policy in the U.S. government, longstanding actions that the government has taken. We really rely and stand behind the evidence and analysis that we produce. We offer that evidence analysis to support our position, and we are more than happy to have conversations about when and where we may be wrong. We find that you know, the evidence doesn't always change everybody's minds. We've had some folks that have been quite
That's
unhappy.
Disheartening.
Right. I mean, we've had some folks that have been unhappy with what we've said, but we try to let the evidence speak for itself.
Great. And in terms of building skills to enter this field, I guess, what do you look for when you're hiring at Griffin? And just more broadly, what skills do you think people should aim to develop when they're looking to do this type of work?
Yeah. So as you saw from my background, right, I don't have a degree in political science. I don't have a degree in sociology, right? I don't have a degree that might be more common to the types of folks you might imagine would go into this space. And that was okay. You know, when I first started at Griffin, I was a contributor to projects. I offered my technical knowledge, and I learned from the folks that had been in this space much longer than I have about how we go about implementing the things that I presented. So I would say, for Griffin specifically, you know, we look for strong technical skills and people that are interested in applying those technical skills to policymaking. But if you're interested in policymaking broadly, I would say, you know, find an organization that is working on an issue similar to yours and is looking for people that have skills similar to yours, and really develop those skills on the job.
And aside from Griffin, are there other organizations that you think if people are interested in this work, they should take a look at?
So with respect to the bio issues that we think about, so Griffin is, I think, probably the most heavily technically oriented and analytical organization. I mentioned NTI. I'm really fond of the work that NTI does in this space. They tend to do more convening of stakeholders. They tend to focus on higher level, more senior stakeholders than we do to sway opinion on what things people should care about. But I think that the way that they think about the biospace is quite sophisticated. And then one of the other major players is the Center for Health Security out of Johns Hopkins. The Center for Health Security does a lot more work directly with Congress and interactions with the legislative branch on the types of things that they're seeking to achieve.
And with NTI Bio, could you say a bit more about the AIX Bio Forum? Like, what concretely is that, and what stage is it at, and what are you hoping for in the future?
Yeah, great question. So it's still on the drawing board. It's still being scoped out. It's an idea that came to mind about 6 months ago. It was motivated by a couple of things. First, that we at NTI Bio had seen a lot of calls to action from the AI and bio communities, that a lot of things needed to be done with respect to AI and bio risk. But there was, I think, a tilt toward a call to action and fewer people actually implementing those actions. Mm-hmm. We wanted to create a home where we could actually implement the suggestions that others are having. We also realized that many of those stakeholders have full-time jobs and they don't have the time to devote to taking on the things they think need to be done. But with something like a stakeholder forum, upon the advice of those stakeholders who could tell us what they think needs to be done, if the forum were staffed by permanent staffers who could take on that work, we could begin to make progress. And then lastly, you know, right now, a lot of the driving forward in this space has been done by some of the biggest players, right? Anthropic is moving mm-hmm. heavily, OpenAI moving heavily, but there's a huge number of organizations that just don't have the same resource levels that these major players do. And they're going to be just as important to help with safety and security around AI. And of course, right now, you know, there's a lot of efforts taking place in a small number of countries around the world, but as the AI field continues to grow, we think that's going to become global. So the last aim of the forum is to gather global stakeholders and do things like develop standards, develop best practices, develop communication lines, so the less well-resourced components of the ecosystem have access to the same tools and techniques and individuals they need to achieve the same safety and security aims.
And I guess looking forward to the next year, which part of that do you think is going to be most challenging and where do you see most promise? If you look into your crystal ball, which you obviously have.
Yeah. So I think I've been relatively pleased with the amount of attention that's being placed toward evals and red teaming exercises in AI bio. Right now, it's done by folks on a bespoke basis, as I mentioned, but I think if the level of attention and intensity and spotlighting can stay on that issue, we're going to really make some significant progress on that in the next year. The most challenging component in my mind is trying to develop global cooperation on these issues. Mm-hmm. I think the geopolitical situation being what it is, some of the government players in this space are pretty cautious about wanting to be globally engaged, but I think we are, you know, we're only as safe as our least safe place. Mm-hmm. And so without global cooperation, we're not likely to make the progress we need.
Great. An audience question. So in testifying to Congress and presenting to government executives, what were the kind of best and worst questions they asked, and what did you learn from that for your comm strategy?
So in testifying to Congress is a bit different than you might expect. So we actually got fewer questions than we expected from Congress. Mm-hmm. We were asked to provide written testimony where we got no questions. We were also asked to show up in front of a hearing and answer questions. Testifying to Congress is a little unusual where often the questions are sort of preformed. It's not really a back and forth dialogue. And so why those questions are asked can be motivated by a huge number of reasons. And so I wouldn't really say the types of questions that Congress asks are really aligned with, I think, the reason for asking that question. In talking to executives, you know, this may seem like a bit of a cop-out answer, but I believe it's true. There's not really good and bad questions, right? Our job in that space is to really inform executives, and we want them to be able to come to us with where they actually are and ask the questions that may make them feel vulnerable because they may not know what the answer is, and for us to take those questions seriously. I think, broadly speaking, the question that we get asked most is how much should I really care about AI and bio risks? And our approach to that is to walk them through, right, not to answer that question with sound bites, but to really take the time to walk them through in detail why we think the risks are what they are and you know, what the near, medium, and long-term potential is.
Mm-hmm. And have you noticed any change in the last couple of years of how your work is received by the US government, given the potential increased turbulence in the kind of US political system?
Yes and no. I will say that we are fortunate enough to work on issues that are generally non-controversial politically. So there are reasonable and sometimes strong disagreements about how to approach a particular policy issue. But it is not as challenging as it is to work in some areas of politics where there are radical disagreements about how to proceed. see with administrative transitions during presidential elections that there is often an interruption in government as they set their new priorities and determine how they're going to go about implementing those priorities. But I think that's a natural consequence of, you know, a democratic system.
And how long is that disruption typically?
That varies. So for us, that varies based on the approach to governance of whoever has won the election and the relative prioritization of the issues that we care about. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it can be pretty small. In the worst case, it can take years before the new players who are tasked with implementing the priorities we care about get into their seats and ready to move.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned your issues being typically less controversial, but I guess gain of function seemed, at least from the outside, fairly controversial. How was working in that area?
Yeah, so that was quite interesting because you heard everything from there's absolutely no reason to be doing this research, we are way out of control, to you cannot possibly put controls on this research because it is so beneficial and you're going to ruin the scientific enterprise. Mm-hmm. So yes, it was controversial. And I think there is sort of a lack of understanding on either sides of that argument and a lack of data and evidence to understand, you know, what the realm of actual possibilities was and how we should move forward. Our hope was, and my belief is, that the analysis that we provided was able to inform those that really believed in the science what the risks may be, and those that were really in favor of the risks to understand what the benefits may be, so that everyone could get to the table and discuss it more. But I will say, you know, compared to some political issues, the controversy and heat in gain of function was nothing compared to those.
Mm-hmm. And do you foresee the work in AIX Bio generally staying away from the kind of political polarization, or insofar as like you have a view into the system?
That's a great question. I don't have an answer to that. I would say that what becomes a political hot button issue can be very surprising and unanticipated.
Yeah, because I guess I sort of assumed that about gain of function, and I was very surprised that this is an issue that people cared very deeply about on different sides. So fingers crossed, I guess.
Yeah.
great. So final question. Is there something that you would like to like leave the audience with, or a message or hope for the next year?
I think if I were to emphasize one thing, it would be my last slide, which is to pick your passions. I think it's really important when thinking about the impact that you want to make to focus on things you have the bandwidth to take on and not get distracted by all the ways one could make impact.
Great. Thank you so much. Please join me in thanking Dr. Ryan Richardson.
Thank you.